He began to reply to the inquiries of Maharaj Pritchett by saying that the science of the personality of Godhead was first spoken by the Lord himself to Brahma when he was first born. Srimad Bhagavatam is a supplementary Vedic literature, and it is just in pursuance of the Vedas. So Srila Prabhupada's purport. Srimad Bhagavatam is the science of the personality of Godhead. The impersonalist always tries to represent the personal feature of the Lord, not knowing the science of this great knowledge, and Srimad Bhagavatam is in pursuance of the Vedas and scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead. To learn this science, one should take shelter of the representative of Sri Shukadev and follow in the footsteps of Maharaj Pritchett without foolishly attempting to interpret, thereby committing a great offence at the feet of the Lord. The dangerous ways of interpretations by the non-devotee class of men have played havoc in understanding the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the careful student should always be alert in this matter if he at all wants to learn the science of Godhead. English again. He began to reply to the inquiries of Maharaj Pritchett by saying that the science of the personality of Godhead was first spoken by the Lord himself to Brahma when he was first born. Srimad Bhagavatam is a supplementary Vedic literature, and it is just in pursuance of the Vedas. Om Agyanam Tiriram Dasya Kajanaya Shalakaya Taksho Om Miditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Tadati Svapatantikam He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namustate Tata Kanta Gorange Radha Vindavanishvare Vishupano Stute Devi Pranam Nami Adipiye Vanta Kaupatrubascha Kipo Simbure Vacha Patitana Pavane Bio Vaishnavio Namo Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Kurvani Pracharine Nivasesha Shunyavadi Prashachade Satadine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Sivasadi Gaurabhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So we're taken back here, are we not, to the very beginning of this universe, before creation, when Lord Brahma had just been born. Of course, here, Prabhupada, of course, is giving special mention in his purport to the significance of the Srimad Bhagavatam, linking this, of course, to the before the creation even of this universe. So even though the Bhagavatam was historically spoken just 5,000 years, well, relatively recent, actually, relatively, just 5,000 years ago, actually it is non-different from the science of the personality of Godhead. Not impersonal, but the personality of Godhead. And this is linked, even going back to the very first prayer of this universe, the Govindam prayers, which we hear, of course, during deity greeting every morning. So all these are basically all complementing each other. They're all saying there's personalities behind everything in the universe. So instead of talking about the Big Bang, we talk about Lord Brahma, for example. And so instead of talking about the impersonal Brahman or the inner light or the oneness, we talk about the personality of Godhead. However, Prabhupada here is mentioning in his purports, so in fact I'll come back to this later, but because it's such a prominent feature in his purport, I'll mention it before I forget. Prabhupada writes, the dangerous ways of interpretations by the non-devotee class of men have played havoc in understanding the Srimad Bhagavatam. In other words, one has to appear in the line of disciplic succession, hear from the spiritual master and repeat what you've heard. But personal interpretations or listening to those who have their own motivation, using the Srimad Bhagavatam for a bit of money, a bit of prestige, for their own ego, for their own, and more importantly, or just as importantly, their own purports, their own understanding, especially perhaps if it is an impersonal understanding or some other type of non-bona fide way of approaching the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Srimad Bhagavatam is, as we all know, we hear it often, but it's full of personalities all the way through. It's one leela after another leela, one prayer after another prayer. So there's no way you can easily justify that the Bhagavatam is basically saying, no, no, it's all nothingness, or it's all nihilism, or it's all impersonal, when there's so much personality imbued in the leelas and the other pastimes as described in the Bhagavatam. But here in the verse, of course, here, it's saying that Maharaj Pritchett was saying that the science of the personality of Godhead was first spoken by Lord himself to Brahma when he was first born. So let us cast our minds back now about something in the region of about 155 trillion years, approximately, to when Lord Brahma was first born, when he appeared on this lotus flower, actually, that was coming from the lotus stem, coming from the navel of Garbhadakshay Vishnu. Thank you. Garbhadakshay Vishnu. Lord Brahma found himself there. Actually, he didn't know what he was supposed to do. You imagine it. You awaken. You come into being everywhere around you, every direction, like this, with your four heads, at least, is darkness. There is nothing. You don't know what to do. You hardly know what your purpose is. You are pure intelligence, and yet still there is something higher required in order for creation to truly begin. There's this lotus flower. So what do? You go, okay, what's beneath the lotus flower? You climb down the lotus stem. But he climbed and he climbed and he climbed down and down, and still, apart from the lotus flower and the lotus stem, he could not see anything else. It must have been quite frightening, actually. And for many, many celestial years, he climbed down the stem, but in the end, he gave up, and he had to come back up again. And he realized the process is an internal one. And he meditated, of course, on the words Om Tat Sat. Words of the Om, the universal Tat Sat. This is the universal absolute truth. And at that moment, after meditating internally, he was able to take darshan of Lord Govinda himself. And of course, this instigates, of course, the famous Govindam prayers, which I think I'll share with you a little bit. We're familiar with them. But sometimes, at least myself, I need to be reminded of the English. Because often we hear it, don't we, in deity greeting. And actually, at least preaching to myself, I need to sometimes turn to the English translation to remind myself what it's really all about. So of course, it was spoken by Lord Brahma to Lord Govinda. You imagine you've been in darkness for so long, and suddenly, just like in the cover of the Brahma Samhita, have you seen that, where you've got this Govinda and the spiritual world is opening up above you, and suddenly it all makes sense. Suddenly form, variety, personality, colour, relationships, love is all revealed to you after being in darkness for that extended period of time. So it must have been an amazing experience. What a darshan that would have been. A Maha deity greeting for Lord Brahma there, I think. Of course, in one sense, it's a good meditation for us, I suppose, at 7 a.m. in the morning, to have that kind of that experience. And the amount, the knockout beauty of Lord Krishna when the curtains open. So perhaps the original deity greeting was trillions of years ago. So actually, there's 100 chapters in the Brahma Samhita, but it's the fifth chapter of the Brahma Samhita that was discovered by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of course, 500 years ago. The other chapters, unfortunately, have not yet been revealed. Many of them, in terms of being written down, may have been burnt over the years or destroyed. There's been ancient great libraries of India were attacked or destroyed or burnt by fire, whatever, or things were just lost over the years, which is unfortunate. But you imagine that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu rediscovered one of the most important chapters of the Brahma Samhita. So there's one chapter, and there's actually another 61 chapters that have been historically lost into antiquity. So you imagine if they were discovered, it'd be amazing. Maybe they're somewhere yet to be found. So let's look at a little bit. I'll just do the invocation mantra of the Brahma Samhita, and I'll just do one sample as well, just to get ourselves in the mood, and then I'll just talk a bit about the Brahma Samhita. Isvara Parama Krishna Satchitananda Vigraha Anadi Narani Govinda Savakarma Karanam Chintamani Prakakara Satmakal Praviksha Laksha Viteshu Saripi Apipale Antam Lakshmi Sahasra Shatasam Brahma Sevyamanam Govinda Maripusham Tamaham Vajami. So just a small sample. So I remember actually reading one of the first books I read actually in Krishna consciousness was the Brahma Samhita, you know, the purport and translation by, of course, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. And immediately you actually can see the difference in writing style between Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada. Bhaktisiddhanta's English is very high Victorian style English, and it's very, very high consciousness. Just by, even if we can't understand every line of his purports, just by reading and exploring his use of the English language is enlightening in itself, because he's pointing to something higher, and that's expressed in the language. If you read the back of the Brahma Samhita of this particular copy, it reads, "Nothing vague about Brahma's description of the Lord and his abode is in this book. No dim, ritualistic nothingness. No blinding, bright lights. No whimsy, dreaming visions. Rather, a vibrant, luminescent world in transcendental colour, form and sound." So this is the back of the book. Imagine he's basically attacking impersonalism. Now you've got to also remember, in the time of Bhaktisiddhanta, there was a lot of, not only was the Sahajaism and things like that, especially during the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but also a lot of Maivadi interpretations as well of what would be traditionally more Vaishnava scriptures. And Bhaktisiddhanta would preach very strongly against this interpretation. So I thought I'd kind of read, just to get ourselves in the mood of the Brahma Samhita, and I'll do a better job of the English than the Sanskrit, no doubt. I will read the invocation, and plus just maybe just four verses. Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the supreme Godhead. He has an eternal, blissful, spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin, and he is the prime cause of all causes. I worship Govinda, the primeval lord, the first progenitor, who is tending the cows, yielding all desire. In abodes built with spiritual gems, surrounded by millions of purpose trees, always served with great reverence and affection by hundreds of thousands of Lakshmis or gopis. I worship Govinda, the primeval lord, who is adept in playing on his flute, with blooming eyes like lotus petals, with head bedecked with peacock's feather, with a figure of beauty tinged with the hue of blue clouds, and his unique loveliness charming millions of cupids. I worship Govinda, the primeval lord, round whose neck is swinging a garland of flowers, beautified with the moon locket, whose two hands are adorned with flute and jeweled ornaments, who always revels in pastimes of love, whose graceful threefold bending form of Shamsunda is eternally manifest. I worship Govinda, the primeval lord, whose transcendental form is full of bliss, truth, substantiality, and is thus full of the most dazzling splendor. Each of the limbs of that transcendental figure possesses in himself the full-fledged functions of all the organs, and eternally sees, maintains, and manifests the infinite universes, both spiritual and mundane. So there's nothing impersonal about that. It's the almost like the emphasis, let us say, is focused almost entirely on form, variety, love, and relationships. How can one have an impersonal interpretation? And Bhaktisiddhanta himself is basically saying exactly the same thing. But of course, the impersonal philosophy is nothing whimsical. It is ultimately the beginning stages, the first stage of God realization. Understanding the impersonal Brahman is understood to be a stage, call it a bona fide stage, if you will, of God realization. It's just that the next level, of course, is Paramatma, super soul realization, and then the realization of Parabrahman, the supreme Brahman, the personality of Godhead. So perhaps for those who would otherwise not even be in the mode of goodness and have no understanding of spiritual life, the sense of oneness in itself is at least a beginning. But for us Vaishnavas, we say no. Beyond the rays of the sun, so to speak, is the sun globe. And of course, within the sun globe is the personality of the sun god. So we can appreciate the sun rays, but we have to understand it has a source, just like the light in this room has a source up there with these nice chandeliers, like that. So interestingly enough, even the four Kumaras, imagine how high they are up in the universe, up there with Janaloka, Tapaloka, much more superior planets in the universe to this one in terms of longevity and consciousness. Yet, they were very old. I mean, they didn't look old. They had the mystic power to remain about 4 or 5 years old, no more. The eternal toddlers. But actually, they were very, of course, very, very intelligent and mature. But actually, they weren't always personalists. In the beginning, they were impersonalists, and they were far more intelligent than us. So that gives you an idea of the power. Yes. So, but would you say that's the same as impersonalism? Okay, can I explain? Pass the mic.
The difference between impersonalism and Brahmavadis is that impersonalists, they almost like negate the existence of the Supreme Lord. But Brahmavadis, they only stage of understanding is, at this point, is the Brahman concept. So it's like Prabhupada explains, is because they haven't received yet the mercy of the devotee or the Lord to understand the personal feature. But they don't negate it as it doesn't exist.
I see. So what you're saying is, impersonalism, or Maivad for that matter, is almost proactively saying it's definitely no personality. Yeah. Whereas the four Kumaras, until they became personalist, were kind of like, we just yet hadn't been given darshan, so to speak.
Shukadev Goswami was in the same category, actually. Shukadev Goswami and four Kumaras have been considered to be Brahmavadis.
And that's also interesting. That's also consistent with the idea that you've got different stages of God realization. And that the beginning or the early stages of God realization, you know, the impersonal conception, is not necessarily, let's say, offensive, certainly in the case of the Brahmavadis, as we heard from Antaranga Prabhu there. Because, of course, when they smelt the tulsi leaves and the incense and the offered flowers, they became personalists. So they were not, as Antaranga Prabhu said, they weren't stuck into that impersonal conception. They were just, I guess, in the waiting room, perhaps, is a good one. And it's different being in the waiting room for your appointment with the Lord. It's a good place. You're in the right place. You're in the surgery. You know, you're reading the magazines and you're in the right place. You've got your appointment. But as we kind of touched on earlier, we're not walking away from the surgery. We're not denying that the surgery is there. And there's a difference in mood and attitude. So that's an interesting thing. But the debate, actually, of impersonalism versus personalism is actually, as we've already kind of indicated, it's millions of years old, actually. It's not even, doesn't even go back to, say, Lord Buddha within this recent Kali Yuga, because Lord Buddha himself was an incarnation, of course, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and one of the avatars, Abhyat Satyavesa avatar. Nevertheless, he came for a particular purpose. The philosophy, Gautama Siddhanta, was more based on voidism, but negating the Vedas, simply because the Vedas were being misused so much for animal slaughter and so forth. So here's a good example of someone who was effectively incarnations come according to time, place, and circumstance. And also, we also have to realize, I think, in many ways, I think it was, let's say, Shankaracharya of the 8th century. He was definitely teaching impersonalism. Shishirada Gokulananda ki jai, Shichisita Dharma Sunhanuman ki jai, Shishinigornitai ki jai. Shankaracharya of the 8th century was basically, it's described, if you go on Wikipedia, it's basically saying that Atman and Brahman are one and the same. So in other words, here you have a denial of the personality of Godhead, but it's also understood in our tradition that he was bringing the population back into having faith in the Vedas that may otherwise be contaminated, if you like, by, or stuck, let's say, in the impersonal realm. But what Shankaracharya did, even though he was preaching impersonalism, was putting the Vedas back on the stage by using the authority of the Vedas to preach his doctrine, which is kind of interesting. And unlike the... in fact, he was also influenced by the Mahayana form of Buddhism, which they say was about 1st century India, which is different from the Theravada. My understanding of the difference between the Mahayana and the Theravada forms of Buddhism, the Mahayanas would say that the monks and the experienced Buddhists of India would say the goal is not to escape from the cycle of birth and death, but it's a bona fide process to actually take birth again to continue to preach. In other words, the aim is not nihilistic or nothingness. The aim is to take birth again to help other people. With people, again, personalities are coming in. So there's a subtle difference, whereas the Theravada was basically, let's enter nirvana as soon as possible, you know, because that's the only reality. So it's quite a marked difference. But Shankaracharya's school was more influenced by the Mahayana, because it was from India for a start. It's interesting, actually, because even today, as I kind of indicated, there are many, many movements, religious groups, which are ultimately either impersonal or are semi-impersonal, or not quite sure, or maybe even some form of Brahmavadi, who knows, but the idea of they do not talk about the personality of Godhead. And ironically, there's many, many different forms and varieties of impersonal groups with different names and different teachers and different scholars and different books. Surprisingly, they don't kind of all come together in a sense, but they don't, which is interesting, perhaps even self-defeating, because even within such schools of thought and movements, they have their hierarchies, or they have their personalities, or their doctrine and so forth. So even there, there's form and variety, because it's natural for the human beings to embrace relationships, form and variety. It's just human nature. It's our nature. So even if we are find ourselves floating in the Brahma Jyoti, in the spiritual sky, you know, part of the light that's emanating from Goloka Vrindavan, because we've all experienced, even if it's inferior and kind of horrible in this world, still we're getting a little bit of form. We're experiencing that. So we enter into the Brahma Jyoti, but eventually we'll come down again. Just like, I guess, if you're sitting watching, you shouldn't watch television, I'm not preaching that, but imagine you're sitting there watching television and there's a rubbish TV program on, it's just like a terrible movie. So you switch it off. So you find yourself staring at a blank screen and you're stuck. You don't know anything else. Like Lord Brahma in the beginning of the universe, you've got no choice, you're just looking at this blank screen. Sooner or later, unless you've got a way out, the TV is going to go back on again. So similarly, once we've experienced relationships and forms and so forth, we can never really forget it, so to speak, because we as jivas actually belong in a relationship with the personality of Godhead, for he is the source of all things, including his own effulgence. So even, for example, a bit of history here, why not? Right? So 1017 to 1137 lived Ramanujacharya, who kind of preached the qualified non-dual philosophy. Non-dual meaning oneness, not two. And qualified non-dual, which is a bit different, and actually introduced, I guess, the introduced Bhakti, if you like. Obviously, Bhakti's, you know, been there since time immemorial, but in terms of the traceable history, the non-dual, so he accepts the concept of Bhakti, because although it's not quite one, there's something else going on. There's a separate, just like, for example, you've got the one, but then you've got a kind of something else that's next to it, but not actually completely the same as that. Therefore, you've got the beginning of dualism, actually. But Madhvacharya, who actually appears in our line, so he's very significant, 1199 to 1278 that he lived, his was the doctrine of complete dualism. You've got your God, personality of Godhead, and you've got the jiva, and that's it. And it's possible for them, there's a separation there between them, in a sense. You know, the jiva can perform bhakti, but then again, if he doesn't, then okay. The jiva is quite separate from the Lord. That's not actually the philosophy of our the Gaudiya Sampradaya, of course, of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which is what? It's Chintabheda Bheda Tattva. Inconceivable, simultaneous oneness and difference between the personality of Godhead and the individual souls, the jivas. It's inconceivable. How can something be one but also different simultaneously? It's inconceivable to us. But from the spiritual perspective, it is indeed the fact. It is indeed possible. It's a bit like saying that we are the sparks of the fire. This is the analogy that is given. The spark of fire that we are is the same quality as the rest of the fire. It's fire. It's still going to burn. If you get an incense stick and stick it in your hand, it's going to hurt because it's fire. The same as if you put your hand in a larger fire, it's the same effect. But the quantity is different, but the quality, the substance, is the same. And this is how we can begin to understand inconceivable simultaneous oneness and difference. So we've just 5-10 minutes left. Maybe I'll do more like 10 minutes, because I don't think there's breakfast this morning, is there? Am I right? Oh, half day fast. There you go. So therefore, that gives me an extra 10 minutes to give class. So what I wanted to do in this last section is, because Prabhupada actually talks a bit in his purport of quite a lot about the purpose and the identity of the Srimad Bhagavatam, this personal literature. What is it? Of course, it's the creme de la creme, the Vedanta Sutras, which explains the Upanishads and the Vedas. So it's got the creme de la creme of the creme de la creme. And it's the postgraduate study, if you like. If the Bhagavad Gita is the ABC of spiritual knowledge, the Srimad Bhagavatam is kind of, you know, you're digging deeper, you're going into more. And I actually wanted to read from the purport of the Bhagavatam 1.3.41. Prabhupada writes, "All the stories mentioned in the Puranas and Mahabharata, etc., are actual histories, not only on this planet, but also millions of other planets within the universe. Sometimes the history of planets beyond this world appear to such men as to be unbelievable, but they do not know that different planets are not equal in all respects, and therefore some of the historical facts derived from other planets do not correspond with the experience on this planet. Considering the different situation of different planets and also time and circumstances, there is nothing wonderful in the stories of the Puranas, nor are they imaginary. We should not, therefore, reject the stories and histories of the Puranas as imaginary." So that's setting the scene there. Then Prabhupada adds, "In the Srimad Bhagavatam, historical facts selected from the histories of different planets have been depicted. It is therefore accepted by all the spiritual authorities as the Maha Purana. The special significance of these histories is that they are all connected with activities of the Lord in a different time and atmosphere. The Summa Bhagavatam, it is compared to the cream of the milk. We mentioned that, didn't we? Vedic literature is like the milk ocean of knowledge. Cream or butter is the most palatable essence of milk, and so is the Srimad Bhagavatam, for it contains all palatable, instructive, and authentic versions of different activities of the Lord and his devotees. There is no gain, Prabhupada said, there is no gain, however, in accepting the message of Bhagavatam from the unbelievers, atheists, and professional reciters who make a trade from the Bhagavatam for the layman. It was delivered by Srila Sukadeva Goswami, and it has nothing to do with the Bhagavatam business. He did not have to maintain family expenses, such as trade. Srimad Bhagavatam should therefore be received from the representative of Sukadeva. In other words, Prabhupada, obviously, in India, you do get Bhagavatam reciters, and I'm not saying they're all wrong, some of them may be great, but Prabhupada here appears to be indirectly referring to those that basically will recite Bhagavatam as a profession, who don't really have an understanding of its purpose, or have an incorrect understanding of its purpose, or don't even believe it, or scholars and other offenders, if you like, would be scholars who would basically say it's stories, you know, nice little stories made up by the sages. They didn't have television in those days, so they just told each other stories before they went to bed, but it didn't actually happen. This is, you know, oh, it's mythology, it's mumbo jumbo kind of thing. There are those that would say that. Oh, it's more, or there's those that would say, well, it may be based loosely on a history, but over the years it's been elaborated a bit. They'd say, well, okay, so there was a king, yes, and he had a wife and he did this. But the bit about going to the other planet, or okay, that's going a little bit outside of my experience. That must be mythology. But actually, Prabhupada here is saying, no, we must take a relatively literal interpretation. I think that's the right word. A literal interpretation of the Bhagavatam. Obviously, we have to also use a sense of discrimination as well. In other words, some of the words and some of the pastimes may be impossible for us to believe or to fully imagine, let's say, or to digest. But the point is that historically they happened. We may not be able to imagine it with our brains or even the limited vocabulary of English or another language. But we can have faith that they are historical truths, if not on this planet, but either a very long time ago, somewhere else in the cosmos. So that's the first thing. Second thing is those who speak Bhagavatam, I mean, Brahmanas, for example, in ancient India, would receive a voluntary donations, a stipend, a bit of dakshin from people in the villages or whoever, you know, because Brahmanas were relying on donations. Whether it was door to door or whether they speak Bhagavatam, but it was for the purpose of glorifying Bhagavatam. If donations came so they could basically have their handful of rice that day or whatever the Lord provided, that's fine. But it wasn't, no one should get rich from the Bhagavatam. No one should be glorifying oneself in the name of the Bhagavatam. Or basically, oh, it's so-and-so, oh, great, you know, making a superstar out of somebody who is ultimately accepting glorification for themselves and not the supreme personality of Godhead. So I think that's really important. And not only Prabhupada, but also, of course, Bhaktisiddhanta and, of course, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and the other acharyas would no doubt raise that point. Just to finish then, the purport of the Bhagavatam 284. Prabhupada writes here, it is not such a mechanical process that the professional Bhagavatam reciters can do the job on behalf of the third grade materialistic pseudo-devotee. The professional men are useless in this connection because they are neither self-realized nor interested in the liberation of the audience. In fact, that's the main point. They are simply interested in maintaining the material establishment of family attachment and earning. some material benefits out of the profession. So here, Prabhupada is talking about motive more than. So when we approach the Bhagavatam, we have to question, or we have to address, if you like, or be in the right frame of mind. We have to explore our own motive. We have, what mood am I reading the Bhagavatam in? What am I reading it for? Of course, we may not be in a position where we can make much money from sitting down studying the Bhagavatam. But at the same time, the point here is that those who are making a killing out of the Bhagavatam, we have to be, and especially, if, of course, it's outside of a bona fide sampradaya, we have to be very various. These people, they may be, the scholars, they may be much better, well, they probably are much better, at the Sanskrit pronunciation, for example, or the meters, a bit like Keshri Kashmir Pandit, of course, who was great at Sanskrit, but in the end surrendered, of course, to Nimai Pandit. But the point is that the ability, let's say, to know the Sanskrit, know the verses, the scholarly, the academic aspect of it, is okay. But it's lots of zeros having the material qualification. It's all 0, 0, 0. It's still zero, unless you've got a one in front of it. Then it becomes 10, 100, 1,000. So if you're learned and you're a kind of a sincere Vaishnava, then you've got a large figure. Then you'll be a great preacher. But remember, 0, 0, 0, 0 plus 0, 0, just a bunch of zeros, material zeros, without the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the right motive, is always a million zeros, an infinite amount of zeros, is still a big zero. One, even if you've got no material qualification, you don't really kind of, oh, I can't read this book, I don't understand, I just want to serve, I just want to pick up some litter, whatever it might be, you know, whatever, I just want to do some, wash some pots. That one that person has is still more than a billion zeros. So this is basically really, I suppose, what it's all about. So I think I'll round off there. If there's any corrections or comments, then this is the time. Yeah, has anyone got the mic, please? By the way, I'm not promising I can answer every single question. I'm just by protocol, we're just doing a few minutes here.
Thank you, Prabhu, for the class. I lost my voice at Radha Desvelos. I just, when you were speaking about Sri Shankaracharya, I remember that a composition he did, it's a beautiful chant called Bhaja Govinda, urges people to worship Govinda. It's called Bhaja Govinda, Bhaja Govinda, Madhamate. So as the final only way to really for salvation of mankind.
Yes, that's he does actually glorify the Lord. I mean, interestingly enough, I think in our tradition, in the Vaishnava's tradition, I think that Shankaracharya, by the 14th century, he'd been accepted as an incarnation of Lord Shiva, actually. I don't think he was at the time, but about a few centuries after he lived, he was perceived or understood or accepted, popularly by being an incarnation of Lord Shiva. And like you said, he had that. Remember, these great great personalities, Shankaracharya included, had a particular purpose. One of the purposes was to drive the influence of Buddhism outside of India. Actually, there'd been in the earlier centuries, or between the second to the fourth century in India, there'd been wars and things like that going on, which of course is nothing we would approve of, but. There was a history of tension, actually, and the Vedas ultimately were being undermined in some circles of society. So what Shankaracharya did was, you could call him, he had a divine mission, was to actually re-establish the authority of the Vedas. But like you interestingly pointed out, even Shankaracharya, even though he's the monist, actually had a bit of, he actually said that as well. Do you know the full verse? Bhaja Govinda, Bhaja Govinda, yeah. Yes. So there you go, even Shankaracharya. Hare Krishna.
Thank you for a nice class, Radha. Hare Krishna.
Thank you for your nice kirtan earlier, by the way.
I was just interested in the point that we just talked about, the Mayavad and the Brahmavads. Is there any information about bona fide Brahmavad lines present today? We hear about Sukadev Goswami and so on, which are in previous yugas. Any information about...
Would anyone help me out there? Maybe Antaranga Prabhu have anything about the... I think what he's asking is, are there any people who are... Are there any existing organisations or sampradayas, yeah, if you like, that are actually subscribed to the Brahma?
And from a Vaishnava point of view, are they considered bona fide Brahmavadis like that?
I think, remember one thing, Brahma, if one is a Brahmavadi, it basically means that they haven't actually come to the personal conclusion yet, but they're not proactively denying it either.
So something about the doctrine that they're taught and where they exist.
It's interesting. One thing I will say, there are traditions which have both, appear to have both personal and impersonal kind of conclusions. You'll notice that sometimes to the public, it's general, it's all about mode of goodness teaching and you know, the oneness of God. But actually, sometimes what happens is it comes into the conversation a little bit, just a little bit like as with Shankaracharya, where the teachers, I'm not going to mention anything, any individual, but the teachers will mention it in their presentation. There'll be a reference to it, but then they'll go back a little bit. So they're not offended. It's almost like they are catering, if you like, for a certain level of consciousness. But whether or not that is a Brahmavadi, I would doubt, but I'm not sure. But that would be my knee-jerk response to your question. It may be that there are people who are Brahmavadis, but they don't know it. By definition, they're not sure, you know.
More specifically, were they actually practicing and what is their doctrine?
What is the... I can't help that. Does anyone else have any information about that? Okay, maybe Antaranga can finish everything off. Yeah.
I'm not sure about any sort of a sampradaya related to the Brahmavad concept. It's... I don't think it was ever a sampradaya. It was more like a philosophical doctrine.
Yeah, it's like an approach.
It can be compared to agnosticism. People which are agnostics, they're not against the concept of God, but they just haven't heard or didn't have sufficient amount of knowledge to accept some kind of a statement like, okay, this is something about God. So usually devotees compare these two, agnostics and Brahmavadis, together. Obviously, the Brahmavadis, they have a spiritual wisdom, spiritual understanding, but yet they haven't received the mercy of the devotee to be established on a personal path.
And that's why we distribute books, isn't it, Prabhu?
That's why we distribute books.
We're giving the mercy. In fact, there are a lot of people who are technically agnostic, in a sense, aren't they? I mean, in one sense, it's not an intelligent position to have. They go, well, I don't know if there's a God or not because I've never met him, or what do I know? In one sense, it takes some humility to sit there and say, you know what, I don't actually know. You know, I don't know if there's a God or not. I haven't seen him, they would say. I haven't felt his presence. I mean, I don't know if it's this book or that book. I don't know. What do I know? I'm just this small living being on this small planet floating in a massive expanse of space. What do I know? And in one sense, that takes some humility to actually come to that agnostic conclusion. But, like a Brahmavadi situation, if they are given some, if they have some personal realization or some the correct association, or they read a book, as I did actually, I've been fairly agnostic. I was looking for something. I went through various philosophies, but it wasn't until the Bhagavad Gita with purport by Prabhupada that something clicks. So the Brahmavadi thing, it's almost like it's an attitude or level of consciousness, as it were. But it's not offensive. You know, you're just like, yeah, I don't know.
The four Kumaras, they would be studying some sort of Vedic literature, not just like kind of... That was my thought.
Yeah, they would have been brought up. They would have been brought up in that culture. They would have had... I see what you mean, though. You're saying there's some kind of... doctrinal, is there some kind of... I mean, the Upanishads, for example, are... some people use the Upanishads to preach impersonalism and some not. So there are many, many different scriptures. But anyway, if anyone here... We're going to close the class now. But if anyone here hears of any official Brahmavadi schools that identify themselves as such, because that's the key, they identify, we are Brahmavadis, you know, then please let me know. Okay? Antarad Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.